Murder and Redemption on the Bayou.
The homicides have occurred in a place called Jefferson Davis Parish, and that story is based on real and tragic events. The victims were young, both white and black. They lived in the poor area of the parish. And so it's about these girls, but the larger story is what Dave Robichaux perceives as the end of an era, you know, the end of the Louisiana, certainly, that he grew up in.
That's mystery writer James Lee Burke. We spend the hour with him today talking about the Gulf Coast of Louisiana and the latest novel in his Dave Robichaux series, The Glass Rainbow. That's coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Mystery writer James Lee Burke's real life and fictional life have a way of intersecting. Like the protagonist of his best-selling detective series, Dave Robichaux, Burke is a native of the Louisiana Gulf Coast and divides his time between that beleaguered region and Montana. Like Robichaux, he's got a daughter named Allifair, who's a writer. And both Burke and his character have been around the block a bit, having already passed the 70-year mark. Burke sees his fictional alter ego as the better man of the two, a hero who puts his life on the line defending the powerless and the abused. But Robichaux is haunted by his psychic demons, his alcoholism, intimations of mortality, and moral ambivalence around the use of force against the forces of darkness. Burke, who's written more than 20 books, won an Edgar Award for two of them, Black Cherry Blues and Cimarron Rose. His character Dave Robichaux has been played by Tommy Lee Jones in the film The Electric Mist and by Alec Baldwin in Heaven's Prisoners. The setting for the latest novel in the Robichaux series, The Glass Rainbow, is the sugarcane and bayou country of Louisiana, where crime, corruption, and the twisted strands of class and race are the ground for epic battles between good and evil. Robichaux teams up with his best friend Cleet Purcell to solve the mystery of a young woman's murder. The trail heads at first into the seamier side of town, but then veers into a thorny thicket leading to the plantations of the most powerful people in the parish. When I phoned James Lee Burke at home in Montana, BP's Deepwater Horizon well was still gushing a torrent of oil into the waters of the Gulf. So when I asked him to talk about the setting for The Glass Rainbow, it soon became clear that Burke's heart was mightily pained by what was happening to his beloved home region.
Well, Louisiana is a area that, for good or bad, is in transition and has been during Dave Robichaux's and my lifetimes. It's under terrible environmental stress, not simply because of this oil well disaster, but it has been for decades, and the wetlands are eroding away. 25 square miles of the Louisiana wetlands disappear each year, and eventually they will not be there. The loss is just enormous. I think 46% of the wetlands of the United States are in South Louisiana, but this oil well disaster is... it has consequences that are hard to predict, but they're all very bad. It's a disaster beyond a disaster, because before this oil well blowout, there were 10,000 miles of channels, canals, cut by petrochemical companies from salt water into freshwater marsh areas. They didn't set about to destroy the wetlands. But the consequence is not debatable. The saline intrusion kills the root systems of the native grasses and the cypress and the willows and the gum trees. And so the wetlands are just simply washing away. They're contributing factors. The alluvial soil of the Mississippi was impeded by the construction of power dams through the upper Midwest and the Missouri River floodways. But the consequence is that an Edenic paradise is just going down the drain. It was a beautiful place. Louisiana was one of the most beautiful places, not in this country, but probably on the earth. And the damage to it is just absolutely enormous.
It must be a personal loss for you as well.
For everyone, just for everyone who's been there, who understands what it was, what it is, and what it's becoming. And it's hard to watch. It is hard. It is a hard thing to witness. It's because these guys do business with baseball bats. I think Mr. Obama is a good man, but I don't think he knew the kinds of men he was dealing with. These guys are cut out of different cloth. Their arrogance, their disingenuousness is obvious. I mean, one only has to listen to their rhetoric to show their disdain for the listener. But these men were lying. They were lying. They gave misinformation to all the regulatory agencies about the gravity of the blowout. Look, think about it this way. I used to be in media. I was a newspaper reporter. From the outset, the wrong term was used for what happened. And it's not coincidental. It's not an oil spill. An oil spill is leakage from a tanker. Only a certain amount of potential volume exists. Once that is gone, the disaster has reached its zenith. Also, an oil spill is largely on the surface. It can be contained. This is an oil well blowout. The source has infinite potential. It's 5,000 feet below the surface, and it puts out flumes that are three-dimensional. The bottom of the ocean is polluted. The middle of the ocean is polluted, and the surface is polluted. These fellows began by putting dispersants in the water that sink the oil to the bottom so people can't see it. But from, in my view at least, from the beginning, these fellows were dissembling. They were trying to deceive as many people as they could. They did it methodically. And that fellow who got on television and said before the whole world, this will have a very, very modest impact on the environment, was either indicating he's ignorant of his own technology or he's lying. But it's one or the other. And this is the man that was running the company. I don't think he's an unknowledgeable person.
Yeah, and as you actually write pretty eloquently, and I have to say actually very eloquently, your language is beautiful. In your book, The Glass Rainbow, obviously you wrote it before this oil release volcano, some people have called it, came about. But you do sketch out very much the same kinds of social relationships. Your hero, Dave Robichaux, obviously does not have a warm spot in his heart for what you call the oligarchy of the region.
Yes. Dave Robichaux refers to the oligarchy, and it seems like a foreign term to the vocabulary of Americans. But the antebellum South was ruled by these patriarchs, fellows who ran the plantation system. And the ethos was as follows. People of great wealth made their money off the backs of others. They made their backs off of slaves. And then during Reconstruction, they made their money off the backs of rental convicts. That's how Angola Prison came into existence. It became the model, actually, during Reconstruction for the rental convict system that spread all over the South. Well, cultures don't change within a generation or so. Those legacies are still there. And in my view, again, this is one man's opinion, but the money was not there for education. The people remained poor. They remained trained, uneducated, and they worked for what they could get. And that's the world in which Dave Robichaux grew up. Now, that old agricultural oligarchy is slipping into history, but it's been replaced, in my view, by another one, and it's industrial in nature, and they pretty much own the state. And Louisiana is a dumping ground for the petrochemical industry. Look, there's an enormous difference between the people on the ground, the grunts in the trenches who do the work, the drillers, the roustabouts, the oilfield roughnecks, the pipeliners, the welders, the women who work in the industry. They're among the best people I've ever known. The guys up topside are not people who worked on the floor of an oil derrick. These guys are, again, the people who make our foreign policy. They pulled off a coup in Florida in 2000, and two oil men ran this country for 8 years. They weakened, deliberately weakened, all the regulatory agencies. Mr. Bush chose Ken Lay as a screening officer for regulatory appointments. Ken Lay of Enron. These are the guys who were running things. If people want to see a country, or the consequence of a country under a petrochemical oligarchy, they need to visit Louisiana and see how they like the results. I think Mr. Obama's a good man, but I think I was, in his response to dealing with these guys, I just don't think he had the experience of dealing with the Clanton gang. I mean, Wyatt Earp, when he went to the OK Corral, carried a shotgun. You know, that's how the Earps and Doc Holliday won the day. Why? Look, when Wyatt Earp dealt with the bad guys, he knew he was dealing with the bad guys. The Clantons were not gentlemen, and he blew them out of their socks. Do you remember back in, was it the United States Steel that was threatening to go on strike during
With
the,
Kennedy.
With John Kennedy. He
That's
called
right.
all of their exos, their executives in. And one man, one of the senior officers at U.S. Steel said after leaving John Kennedy's office, this man was white-faced. He said it was the worst, most humiliating experience in his life. I mean, Kennedy reamed these guys out, and he just told them they were not going to cripple this nation.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to raise, I think, their prices, weren't they? Something like that.
That's right.
It was during a recession. He said they're not going to get away with it. But that's it. John Kennedy knew how to be Wyatt Earp.
Yeah.
Mr. Obama thinks a good man, but he bought into it. Well, he bought into these fellows.
We're talking with James Lee Burke. And we're talking about the Gulf, but we're here to talk with him also about his newest novel in the detective series. It's called The Glass Rainbow, and it's a Dave Robichaux novel. Tell us a little bit about your protagonist. He's a man, first of all, who's staring his own mortality in the face in some way.
Yes, the book does brood on mortality, and it's the kind of confrontation philosophically that I think all thinking people go through. You know, we have to confront, you know, the concept of mutability, the fact that, as Heraclitus said, everything changes, even our atomic structure, our cellular structure. You can never put your foot in the same river twice. And we live with that terrible question mark about how well we'll do when we have to, you know, face our ultimate fate. Robert Frost put it better than I. Once, when he was speaking extemporaneously, he was asked about the nature of courage, and he described the Union troops who went up Martha's Heights at the Battle of Fredericksburg, and they went up five times in one afternoon. They literally slipped on their own gore. They went right up into Jackson's artillery. And one soldier said to the other, "I bet you're scared, ain't you?" And the other fellow said, "Oh, yeah, and if you was as scared as I am, you'd run away." And then Frost added, he said, that's what courage is about. Wondering how well you're going to do if you're put unjustly against a wall and about to be shot. He said that would be the worst fate that probably any human being could face. And he said, ultimately, this is what you have to brood upon as part of our lot. It's part of the human condition. And so Dave's 72 years old as this book begins, and he is thinking along those lines. He puts it this way, I think, in another book. At a certain age, mortality is not an elective study. but this has been my experience. I'm a little older than Dave. I'm 1 year older than Dave. At a certain point in one's life, he comes to a certain conclusion. One, that very little wisdom comes with age. And secondly, that death has always been with us. It does not suddenly make its appearance in the seventh inning stretch. It was always there. We just didn't see it. And once a person realizes that, he doesn't fear it any longer.
Mm. And death is staring us right in the face in this novel. Yes. As you open the novel, seven young women had been brutally murdered.
Yeah.
Most of them were prostitutes, but then the body of a young black woman, Bernadette Latiolet, is found. She's an anomaly in this series, yeah. And that really sets him on his way. Of course, without giving away any of the twists mm-hmm. and turns of the plot, tell us a little bit about this.
Well, as you say, the homicides have occurred in a place called Jefferson Davis Parish, about 60 miles from Dave's home, and that story is based on real and tragic events. A person can just Google Jefferson Davis Parish homicides, and the material will pop right up on the screen. I think there are eight that have occurred since the year 2005, and they're unsolved. And the victims were young, both white and black. They lived in the poor area of the parish. Most were related. Most knew one another. But there was this almost pathological lack of interest in their fate. It was received very little coverage. I'm not criticizing the local media. I used to be a newsman. It's the nature of the beast. We pay attention to the passing of the rich and the powerful. The fate of those who have no voice, who belong to that anonymous, what is today called a new underclass, are those who seem to warrant very little interest. And that's why predators target these people. There's no question about it. And so it's about these girls, but the larger story is what Dave Robichaud perceives as the end of an era, you know, the end of the Louisiana, certainly, that he grew up in.
And why?
There anymore.
For the reasons that you talked about before, or in some other way as well?
I beg your pardon?
You say an end of an era. Do you mean in the sense that you were referring to before at the beginning of our conversation, or do you mean the end of an era in a different way?
Well, I'll put it this way. The culture, which was always French Catholic, is much of it has been compromised. The language is gone. You hear French spoken once in a while. But just going back, say, to the 1950s, in the country, out in the parish, almost no one spoke English. You'd never hear it spoken. And most of the people, adults you would speak to, could not speak English. They could not get beyond to say a few words, hello and goodbye. In town, even a city like Lafayette, it was about half and half. That's not true anymore. It's for whatever reason, it's disappeared. In part, the educational system did it. Beginning in the 1950s, children in both the parochial and the public schools were not allowed to speak French on the school ground.
Wow.
And it became associated, French culture became associated in the popular mind with ignorance, backwardness, provincialism, and people became ashamed of their heritage. That's not true now, but the damage is done. They were taught that somehow their language that they had spoken since they came there in 1755 was somehow not culturally acceptable, whereas they came from a culture that was incredibly complex and wonderful, and it was filled with glorious deeds. The poem Evangeline by Longfellow, of course, about the journey of the French Acadians from Nova Scotia to St. Martinville. But years ago, I mean, Louisiana had its flaws. There was no question about it, you know, the segregation, the mistreatment of people of color. But it had many fine things that were put aside as well.
And Dave Robichaud does take up the cause, does champion the cause of Bernadette Latiolet, of finding out who did her in. And in doing so, he uncovers an incredible network of relationships, of connections. His trail leads to one bad guy, Herman Stange.
Yeah.
I found him to be a really disturbing character. For one thing, I wasn't really sure what role he was playing here. He was, you know, he's seems to be the evil incarnate in some way, and yet he came from a background that was quite abusive himself.
Well, that's it. That, you know, the book, I think it's in the Book of Kings in the Old Testament, the narrator says, the sins of the fathers are visited upon their sons unto the seventh generation. And I think that statement means that evil is sequential. It perpetuates itself. Herman's mother was a prostitute. He was treated terribly as a child. He lived in the crib where she worked. And New Iberia had one of the largest brothel areas in the South from the time of the Civil War right up until the 1960s. And he came out of that background. And he's a procurer and a dope dealer. He's a vile man. He sells addiction and misery and death to his own people. But we do discover that this guy was not created in a vacuum. Robert Penwarne's novel, All the King's Men, based on the life of Huey Long, you know, the governor of Louisiana, who was assassinated, contains, I think, the same theme, that Huey Long, or the fictional character, Willie Stark, is a demagogue, a kind of dictator in denim out of the North Louisiana hill country, totally corrupt, eventually shot down. But when all's said and done, we realize that Willie, or Huey Long, rose to power because the old oligarchy abandoned its own supposed obligation, noblesse oblige, to do right by the people less fortunate than themselves. And they created this monster because Huey really knew how to work up a mob. I mean, he was a master at it. Did you know that Spiro Agnew's speechwriter kept a collection of Huey Long's speeches on Air Force Two?
Never did.
That's right. Most of those alliterative usages, like negative nabobs.
Yeah, the nattering nabobs.
Whatever.
I remember that one.
Those came from Huey's speeches.
Wow.
Oh, Huey was terrific. He'd pull up in front of a general store at night and light a truck flare and stob it down into the dirt road and get up on an apple box. And, you know, he was a real sweaty character, wearing a linen suit and a Panama hat, and his first line was always, "All right, you hicks." And, boy, people would growl and mutter, and he'd say, "That's right, I called y'all hicks, because you're a hick and I'm a hick, and us hicks has got to stick together. By God, I see blood on the moon. Give me that meat axe." And people would be screaming. And of course, totally vapid rhetoric. But boy, Huey was a master. He was kind of the Samuel Adams of Louisiana. He could have a town in flames in minutes.
Well, you show right there, though. I mean, he was a populist.
Oh, well, that's, yeah, of course. He was pretty good at acquiring. He used to say he was always great at spending OPM, that's other people's money, and then he took a pretty good chunk of it himself. No, he was a dictator, though. He used the state police to smash up newspaper presses. They came in with sledgehammers and did it.
Really?
My grandfather was one of the few who testified against him. At his impeachment hearing, my grandfather was president of the Louisiana Senate at the time, and Huey was indicted. He was going to be impeached. And the night before his impeachment hearing or trial, the state police visited the homes of all the witnesses and threatened them. And he didn't do it to my grandfather, though. He was a man of enormous integrity. He was a friend of Franklin Roosevelt and was appointed the head of the Public Works Project in Louisiana. But he was one of the very few who would raise his voice.
Hmm. And and you got into journalism yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who did you write for?
Oh, I worked for a newspaper in Lafayette back in the early 60s.
And did you find out a whole lot about the oligarchy during your time as a reporter?
Oh, sure. Well, it's kind of like finding out about the sunrise in the morning. It was a way of life.
People
very powerful ran towns, economies, who ruled parishes like medieval monarchs. That's not a hyperbole. St. Mary Parish in particular, Acadia Parish, St. Landry Parish.
And
brothels were run by the police, the sheriff's department in St. Landry Parish. The gambling was. The dealers in the saloons and brothels wore badges. And no one would believe things like this. It was a way of life back then. The head of the state police was a man named Grevenberg during the 1950s. He started shutting down all the gambling dens and the brothels. He was the most hated man in the state of Louisiana. That's a fact.
Did you write about any of this as a reporter?
Oh, no, I didn't. No, that kind of stuff would never make print.
Really?
No. No, of course not.
And so you, in a way, you're reporting about it in your books.
Well, after the fact, I guess, but no, news media didn't go near stories like that. And if a story like that was published, it never had legs, but it very rarely. I don't remember an instance of anybody trying to report on that level of corruption. Sometimes in Baton Rouge, there would be investigations into corruption in the penal system, Angola, and misuse of state funds, but no. This is what occurred. Back during the 1920s or probably the early 30s, Huey Long was U.S. Senator at that time, and he made a deal with Frank Costello, the mafiosa, who was a member of the Chicago Commission. Huey Long literally gave the state of Louisiana to the mafia. He turned it over to them, and they were given carte blanche. And the mob was run by a crime family there in New Orleans. And that's when all of the slot machines went in every place, drugstores, grocery stores, hotel lobbies. They were ubiquitous in the state of Louisiana. The slot machines were purchased, not though in New Orleans. The purchase came out of New Iberia. The money for it came out of New Iberia. But they were everywhere, along with the brothels and anything else. Look, today there are drive-by daiquiri windows all over South Louisiana. You pull up to the window, it's $5 for a mixed drink, and you drive away with it. They're all over. On their place conveniently next to the four-lane highway between New Iberia and Lafayette. Mothers Against Drunk Drivers protest once in a while, but I can't remember the last time I heard anyone even take exception to it.
Well,
no matter how, Louisiana has the highest rate of highway fatalities in the United States. There's no outcry. It's just a way of life. It's bread and circuses and for the poor and 8.5% sales tax. That's how it works.
Little darling, love is not a crime. If it isn't, let me do my time. Lock my heart, throw away the key. I'm a prisoner that don't wanna go free. Come on, baby, kill me with the keys. Come on, make me die with happiness. I know whiskey makes a man a fool, but darling, whiskey ain't got nothing on you.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with James Lee Burke about Louisiana, and that's the setting for his latest novel, The Glass Rainbow. I can see from our conversation here why your characters are, even the heroes, are so deeply flawed. Especially I'm thinking of the sidekick to the protagonist. That's Cleet Purcell. He's a private investigator, a Vietnam vet, like his friend Dave Robichaud. But one I'd say who perhaps more deeply damaged by his experience in Vietnam. So tell us a little bit about Cleet Purcell.
Well, Cleet's the other side of Dave's personality, and he's Dave's old partner from the New Orleans Police Department of years ago. And Cleet is the merry prankster. He's the trickster out of folklore who gets even for the rest of us. And like Dave, he's a man, though, ultimately, who has the virtues of the knight he rant. They're both gentlemen, ultimately, and men of honor, and both admirable. Dave's the idealist, and Cleet, though, is the pragmatist, the guy who believes that ultimately people might say they respect St. Francis of Assisi, but when they really want help, they call for Wyatt Earp. We always venerate saints when we're safely down history from them. We like them in the abstract, but collectively, I mean, people, they want Cleet Purcell driving a tank through a stucco house. You know, Cleet's only too happy to oblige. He's a great character, great guy.
He is a great character. But this, I think this was a part that I struggled with in your book, because here, both, as you say, he goes in like Wyatt Earp. Robichaud also is not above a little bit of, you know, what could shade over into police brutality, you'd say. They both go after who they see the bad guys, even before the bad guys have been charged with a crime. So what's your take on this? Do you really think it's okay for police detectives and private investigators to go around nearly killing people?
Well, okay, that's a good question. Dave Robichaud's violence, though, when it occurs, usually happens in defense of someone else. And Dave always indicates, without exception, that violence is the first alternative of the frightened and the unknowledgeable, the ignorant, the primitive, whereas it is the last choice of an intelligent and informed person. And he also indicates that even though maybe his violence was justified, it degrades and demeans everyone involved with it. And most of all, it degrades the man who initiated it himself. That no one walks out a winner from a violent incident. Cleet Purcell's violence is usually aimed at certain kinds of people, in particular child molesters, those who prey off the defenseless, who brutalize women, who in effect are the cruelest kinds of bullies, and he visits a pretty rough form of justice on them, but in some cases they get carried away. But I think it's the nature of the beast. You see, I used to work in social welfare in California, and I worked with convicts, a lot of them, and I worked with people who had abused their children, had their children taken from them because they were a threat to them. And it's hard for people to understand what level of damage predators do to the innocent who don't have anyone to take care of them. Anyone who's ever been a victim of violent crime, who hears me talking now, knows I'm telling the truth. When you're a victim of a violent crime, you're on your own. Motion pictures, television series, any number of them, portray dedicated cops showing up, investing their whole careers in getting justice for the person. Social workers are there. Forensic psychologists talk on and on during the film or the show. It doesn't work that way. These guys are buried in workload. Sometimes they're incompetent. Sometimes they couldn't care less. Sometimes they're callous. But even the most dedicated people of law enforcement drowned in the bureaucracy. And then most of the time, culprits get off. Something like 4% of the crime in this country is actually punished. So for Cleet and Dave, what they do to some of these guys probably is something that should have been done to them a long time ago. It's just a very imperfect system. It's simply imperfect. It's just broken and has been for a long time.
Race is next to class as the other great social rift in the glass rainbow. I asked James Lee Burke how he approaches the issue of racism in the novel.
When people say racism, they mean different things on different levels. In the South, racial segregation was a kind of legalistic definition for the culture. What was really going on was not segregation at all. The South was never segregated. It wasn't segregated in terms of culture. It wasn't segregated in terms of sexuality or commerce. That's all nonsense. It was segregated in terms of the distribution of power, and that was always the issue. And it was the exploitation of the blacks that, in effect, allowed a very small minority of Southern whites to do very well, both in antebellum days through Reconstruction and up until the Civil Rights era that began in the early 1960s. But the other kind of racism, which is pathological, a hatred and fear and loathing of someone because of the pigmentation in his skin, is less of, I think, a regional manifestation than one that's simply endemic in the culture. I mean, the national culture, it's there. It's in the nativist movement. goes back to the 1830s, fear of loathing toward the Irish and the Catholics. Later, same kind of animosity directed at Italians in the 1890s. It's a thread that runs in a very dark way through our fabric, going back to the early 19th century up to the present. It manifests itself in different ways. The Klan, of course, it was formed right after the war between the states, and then the rebirth of the Klan in the 1890s, which was a reaction to the spread of populism, and then later in the 1920s. But we also see other manifestations of it, vigilantism, the McCarthy era, the American First Committee. And we've got another group around today. They're with us, and they don't call themselves nativist, the Know Nothing Party, but they share a lot of commonalities. The rhetoric is the same. The emotions are the same. And it has nothing at all to do with region. In the South, people, poor white people and the blacks, were taught to hate and fear one another. It was inculcated in them. Did you ever see the film or read the book, The Chamber by John Grisham?
No.
In the last scene, Gene Hackman plays the role of this Klansman. He's to be executed in Parchman Penitentiary in Mississippi. And the warden says, well, we're going to have to walk you down to the chamber now. It's the execution chamber. Do you want to say anything? And Hackman says, yes, sir. You know, in my life, I hated many a man. And the one I hated most was myself. It's a tremendous line. I never read one line in literature that said more about the mentality of a poor devil like this. He was taught to blame the black man for the hatred he felt for himself. Wow. And that's exactly the where it comes from. It goes back not to historical events, but a mindset that was inculcated in people. And that's what poor whites were taught. They were taught that the black man was going to take their jobs and take their women. So it was a kind of sexual and economic fear that was bred into them. It's the same way the Civil War started. Before the secession that followed the secession of South Carolina, the other states in the Confederacy, what became the Confederacy, didn't want to get on board. Economic interest, plantation interest in the South, and people who wanted to export cotton for refining or ginning and processing in England, got together with all the prominent our most influential Southern newspapers and began a fear campaign based on the same kinds of fears that Mr. Bush Sr. used in his campaign against Mr. Dukakis, the Willie Horton campaign. It worked with Mr. Bush's campaign, and it worked back in 1861. Fear of the black man is some kind of depraved sexual predator who would attack white women. That's what was used. You can look back in any of those newspaper editorials that were written in 1861. If you want to control people, you have to make them afraid.
Right.
And that's what has occurred. And what people call racism today, which usually they assign to the South, is not really racism. It's about economic exploitation. Yeah, they're racist, but the real racist, the man who loathes someone for the fact that he looks different, is not someone with regional origins. They're out here in the West. They're in the North.
Oh yeah, and we're seeing just exactly those, the inculcation of those fears happening right now.
Well, yeah, they're out there, and they, of course, these are not people who, you know, dwell upon their similarities to the nativist of the 1830s and 40s and 50s. Did you ever see the film or read the book, The Gangs of New York?
No.
Yeah, it's a great film. It's a better book even about the Irish. And,
yes.
You know, the worst atrocities toward blacks probably in the history of the country were committed in New York City.
Right. And New York City actually was a great support of the slave trade.
That's right. The biggest slave market in the history of the country was on the banks of the Hudson, around the Hell's Kitchens area. Mm-hmm. That's right. There's a great book about that terrible legacy titled New York Burning.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
oh, it's awful. It's hard to believe. You read that book, you cannot believe the cruelty, the acts that were done to African slaves who were in that. They were called barracoons. These were huge prisons where Africans were kept before they were sold down the river, the Mississippi, to the plantations in the South.
And one of them actually plays a role in your book. This word
That's
barracoon
right.
was one
yeah.
that I hadn't known before reading
yeah.
The Glass Rainbow.
Yeah, it's a 19th century term, but you see, in 1809, there was a proscription against the introduction or transportation of slaves into the United States. It was an attempt to start phasing out slavery. That's when a lot of people went into business, and the illegal slaves were smuggled into the country and kept in barracoons, as they were called. But there were some prominent New England families, I think, involved in what was called blackbirding. That was the term for it. And in the South, James Bowie, who died at the Alamo, had been a blackbirder with the Lafitte brothers, Jean Lafitte and his brother Pierre.
So tell us who Jean Lafitte was.
Jean Lafitte was the pirate, a kind of swashbuckling guy, but up close and personal. Probably pretty vulgar and crude and loudish individual. But he stepped into history largely because he helped Andrew Jackson win the Battle of New Orleans. And you see, while Jackson's troops repelled the British invasion at Chalmette, just south of New Orleans, Jean Lafitte, whose pirate fleet was stationed or anchored in Barataria Bay, which today is the site of the worst of the oil blowout, cut off the means of supply or support. In other words, he attacked the British fleet that was in the Gulf of Mexico, and for that he received a pardon for all his crimes, but soon went back to being a bad guy. He started operating out of Galveston and then disappeared down into the Yucatan. Get this, his next headquarters was at a place called Isles de Mujeres, the Island of Women. And that's where he died in a hurricane.
Oh, I know. That's down in the near Cancun.
Yeah, that's right. And that's where Jean Lafitte died. He was lost in a storm. But he was just one of those genuine bad guys who never wanted to be anything but a bad guy.
And in your book, James Lee Burke, you got a lot of bad guys and some good guys. We barely really talked about the book itself. You've been regaling us with such wonderful stories about the history of Louisiana and that time. It is a terrific book. I just want to ask you one thing about the writing of it. And that is, it's a very complex story. There are a whole lot of interrelated plot threads. Did you figure this all out beforehand, or do you write with these mysteries with the mystery itself revealing itself to you slowly as you write?
It's the latter. I've never planned the books, and I never outline them. Ernest Hemingway once said that if he outlined a book, he would know its conclusion, and if he knew its conclusion, so would the reader. So I've always tried to keep that in mind. And my father used to say that both art and science are less creative than simply an act of incremental discovery. He said, my dad used to say, science and art discover what God created and already exists all around us. It's just a matter of vision. We have to see it. And I think that's how art is born. I've never quite understood the process. I believe the characters live in the unconscious. And I think any talent I possess, or any talent that any artist possesses, comes from some source outside of oneself. I think almost all writers or artists would admit that. Those who claim credit for their gift usually are about to lose it. That's always been my experience.
So how did you move from being a journalist to being a mystery writer?
Well, I've always been a writer. That's just how I've always thought of what I wrote. I never thought of it categorically. I appreciate your question. But I started writing stories for publication when I was 19. And I published my first short story in 1956. And then I studied journalism in school, and I went to Southwestern Louisiana Institute, and then later to the University of Missouri. But I've always thought of writing as just writing. I never made much distinction between even nonfiction, you know, essay writing, and the short story, and the short story in the novel, or the play, or the script, film script. And I appreciate, you know, the category that people call mystery writing, but there's not much mysterious about my work. It's just the only difference between my earlier work, which was not as commercially successful as, say, the Dave Robichaux books, is the fact that I used a police officer. Dave Robichaux is the narrator. But I never changed the books I wrote. The themes are all the same. Mm-hmm. And the characters, the kinds of people I write about, have never changed. And the emphasis, the search for redemption, the struggle between good and evil, those things never changed in my work. It's just the voice that told them. But if it were not for the Dave Robichaux books, I'd probably be throwing a morning paper out.
Like the rest of us writers.
Yeah.
Well, you are a terrific writer. The writing itself is really... of course. I mean, I happen to think there's no bad genre, but really the level of, you know, I guess you've been called a poetic mystery writer. It's really stunning language, and it's a pleasure to read. We've been talking with James Lee Burke. His book is The Glass Rainbow. It's the latest in his series, a Dave Robichaux novel. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you for having me on your show. You do a great interview, so I really appreciate it.
Mystery writer James Lee Burke, talking about The Glass Rainbow, out from Simon & Schuster. In addition to 18 novels in the Dave Robichaux series, Burke is also the author of several short story collections, a series set in Montana featuring the character Billy Bob Holland, and other works of fiction. You can read an article James Lee Burke wrote about writing by going to writersvoice.net.
You're calling us healers with zero respect for the law. But we're only songwriters, just writing our songs, and that's all. Write what we live, and we live what we write. Is that wrong? If you think it is, Mr. Music Executive, why don't you write your own song?
We've got some time for two poems from Doug Anderson, recorded at a reading by several poets in March of 2010 to raise funds for the children of Gaza. Anderson saw action in the Vietnam War. His first poem, Petitionary Prayer on Nguyen Phi's Roof, takes place in Vietnam many years later.
In 2000, I went back to Vietnam and met with a number of my former enemies who have become poets and fiction writers, and we traveled from the north to the south together. This is about a dinner on the roof of Nguyen Xuy's house in Saigon. Petitionary prayer on Nguyen Xuy's roof. Black sky and moon of chipped ice. We fall on the chicken, the shrimp, the sliced melons. The whiskey picks up the neon from the streets. A sudden breeze cools our damp shirts. Below, children play in the light from open doorways. The heat of the day has made us silent. Lanang, in her simple white dress, pours tea. God make me young again and not stupid. I have a birthday poem. I do these every once in a while. I guess I have a morbid sense of humor. 67th. A rag of my youth, ripe and a little rot, but paid for. If you knew me 40 years ago, you'd run, unless you had a self-destructive streak. Now I see all my selves composting in the soul bag and just grin. If I follow perspective lines out to the white whale, I'll never get there. I've quit. Either I'll get some sinner's rehab in heaven or my putrescence will send up crocuses. I've already done hell, and let me tell you, if I could have missed it, I would. But I wasn't smart in those days. Forethought was for the dead in life. I'd take on anything that promised a jackpot. I'd fall in love like it couldn't hurt me. And love, well, I know less about it daily, although I know that you can scare it away with too much passion. Got a hunch God is nicer than the Bible thumpers have it. I mean, he's old. Nothing he ain't seen. The religious are looking for a virgin to manifest on a billboard, but I'm happy with this basil I've crushed in my fingers, with this old dog whose left hind leg will scarcely hold her up. During my nap, I visited the border. Hayden Carruth was sitting just on the other side, and Jack Gilbert was sitting this side on a rock. Hayden says, "Smells like fresh-cut hay over here. There's garden tomatoes and long-legged girls and light through the honey jar." In jazz, Bird is over here, Monk and Miles and Diz and Duke. It's just like life, only you don't have that self to carry around all the damn day. It's sweet, I tell you. Don't be afraid to just give it up, Jack. There's women over here who want to meet you. When I woke up, I had an orange and then sat on the front steps and watched the dogs sleep in the sun. I wouldn't have it any other way. Thank you.
Poet Doug Anderson reading his birthday poem, 67th, and before that, Petitionary Prayer on Nguyen Xuy's Roof. You can read other poems by Anderson by going to writersvoice.net. Next week, tune in as we go back in time to explore the life and times of two great creative geniuses. We talk first with Harvey Sachs about his book, The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. Then Mark Lamster talks about Peter Paul Rubens. His book is Master of Deception. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.